Okay, I'm going to go ahead and get started. Today I'd like to tell you about some work that we've done related to the mantle viscosity structure. This is work done in collaboration with Ved Lekic from University of Maryland and Carolina Lithgow-Bertoloni from University College London. And this is our CIDR project, which we started 2 years ago. And I actually remembered to wear the same shirt that I was wearing. Let's see. The study was motivated by a number of different observations of funny things going on around 1,000 kilometers depth. First of all, in recent SNP tomographic models, a variety of interesting slab behaviors are imaged, including the stagnation shown here of slabs above 1,000 kilometers depth. So these are slabs that have passed through the mantle transition zone. If you define the transition zone as ending at the base of the 660, and these slabs are ponding above 1,000 kilometers depth. So these are cross sections through the Tonga and Kermadec arcs, and you can see seismically fast material ponding between 1,000 and 660 in this region. This is by no means a ubiquitous feature. In other places, we see slabs enter the lower mantle and sink all the way to the core mantle boundary, apparently unimpeded. Second, in recent whole mantle waveform tomographic images from French and Romanovich, 2015, we see broad mantle plumes that are often deflected between 1,000 kilometers depth and 660. So in this slice through SEM-UCB WM1, you can see actually three different depths indicated. This is 1,000 kilometers depth. This is the 660. And you can see that this plume conduit is offset laterally from the McDonald hotspot, whose location is indicated with the green triangle. And in some places, you can see very clearly that there seems to be shearing or offset of upwelling features between 1,000 and 660 kilometers depth. This is also seen in other models. This is an image of the Iceland plume. So to orient you, here is the cross section that we're seeing. And you can see that at about 1,000 kilometers depth, there's some ponding of upwelling material, lateral offset, and then thinning of the plume conduit. So this seems to be a behavior that's observed beneath a number of present-day active hotspots. And then if you look at the very long wavelength structure present in global tomographic models, it also appears that there's a change in this long wavelength structure around 1,000 kilometers depth. So these are mantle radial correlation functions for shear wave velocity anomaly on the left and P wave velocity anomaly on the right. And the way to read one of these charts, if you're not familiar with it, is that warmer colors imply a higher degree of correlation, cooler colors imply anti-correlation, and you can see how well the structure at one depth is correlated with the structure at another depth by reading off. For instance, if we wanted to know how well the structure at 1,000 kilometers depth is correlated with the structure at 2,000 kilometers depth, we could look here at 2,000 kilometers on the horizontal axis and see where it intersects 1,000 kilometers on the vertical axis. And by doing this, you can see that there's actually a change in the correlation structure, and it appears to occur at or a little bit below 1,000 kilometers depth. I should emphasize that this is the long wavelength correlation structure. We've taken these tomographic models and filtered them so that we're only looking at spherical harmonic degrees 2 and 3. This type of structure persists up to spherical harmonic degree 4, but it seems to go away at higher spherical harmonic degrees. And this is present in both GAP-P4 and also SEM-UCB-WM1. So I'm going to skip this in the interest of time. One possible explanation for the behaviors that we see in tomographic images at 1,000 kilometers depth is that there's a change in viscosity at that depth. So in order to address this, we decided to try to do some new inversions for the radial viscosity structure constrained by the long wavelength non-hydrostatic geoid. And just to remind you, this is the observed long wavelength non-hydrostatic geoid for spherical harmonic degrees 2 and 4 and spherical harmonic degrees 2 through 9. And the geoid is one of the best constraints that we have on the mantle viscosity structure. This goes back to really classic work that was done by Brad Hager in the 1980s. And what he illustrates in this figure from his classic paper is that the total geoid anomaly that's observed at the surface is the combination of the gravitational effect of density anomalies buried within the mantle, and also the deflection of the surface of the Earth and the core mantle boundary induced by flow in the mantle. So depending on the viscosity structure in the mantle, both the amplitude and the sign of the geoid anomaly over, say, a positive density anomaly is sensitive to the viscosity structure. And it was based on this type of reasoning that it was inferred that there's a factor of 30, approximately, viscosity increase between the upper mantle and the lower mantle. So we applied a transdimensional hierarchical Bayesian inversion to this problem. And this illustrates kind of the flow chart of this process. First, we started by inferring wave speed variations using seismic tomography. From those wave speed variations, we calculated density anomalies. And this requires that we know how to convert between density anomalies and seismic velocity anomalies. From the density anomalies, then we can do forward mantle flow calculations, which requires, in turn, that we make a few simplifying assumptions about the physics and also about the viscosity structure that we use. Then, given a set of viscosity values and predictions from these mantle flow calculations, we can calculate the misfit between synthetic and observed geoid. So the synthetic geoid predicted from our mantle flow calculations and the observations. And in order to carry out this comparison, we needed to find some criterion for goodness of fit, a measure of misfit. We also spent some time thinking about the uncertainties in the observed geoid and also in hydrostatic correction. We're not the first people to carry out this type of study. In the interest of time, I can't review all of the literature on Earth's mantle viscosity structure. The most similar study to our own is probably one by Yannick Ricard from the late 1980s. And he used a genetic algorithm approach to try to infer the viscosity within a layered structure where he specified at the outset the number of layers and the depth of the interfaces between those layers. So you can see the types of viscosity structures recovered from that exercise here. A similar study by King and Masters from 1992 adds additional layers to that model. And there are many other inversions for the viscosity profile through the mantle, some of which have even more layers still than this King and Masters study. So before I get to our results from the transdimensional hierarchical Bayesian inversion, I thought I'd point out to you that even using a very simple model for the mantle viscosity structure, there's some evidence that the overall increase or the location of an increase in viscosity between the upper and lower mantle occurs somewhat deeper than the 660. These are plots showing the residual, so the misfit between the observed and modeled geoid, for a very simple model in which there's an isoviscous upper mantle and an isoviscous lower mantle. The only thing that I'm doing is changing the ratio of viscosity between the upper mantle and the lower mantle and changing the depth of the interface separating them. So the depth of the interface is on the vertical axis and the viscosity contrast is on the horizontal axis. And these two panels show the preferred solution if you use as misfit criterion the L2 norm, which we learned about during Ved's talk earlier this week, and also using the correlation, which is insensitive to the amplitude. It's only sensitive to the pattern of the observed and synthetic geoids. So depending on how you define goodness of fit, you get slightly different answers. But in both cases, we see that the preferred location of the interface between layers in this viscosity structure is quite a bit deeper than the 660. It seems to be around 1,000 kilometers depth in this case, and between 1,000 and 1,200 kilometers depth in this case. So even for these simple cases, a better fit is obtained for a viscosity increase below the 660. So we adopt this transdimensional hierarchical Bayesian inversion procedure, and the procedure followed is illustrated here. We essentially start each inversion with a single layer model, so an isoviscous mantle, and then in a Markov chain Monte Carlo procedure, at random, we perturb that model. Using one of five different operations, we can add a layer to the model, we can remove a layer from the model, we can perturb the interface position between two layers selected at random, we can perturb the viscosity of a layer chosen at random, and we can also perturb our estimate of the forward modeling and data uncertainty. Then, given these new forward modeling parameters, we generate a new synthetic geoid. We do the forward modeling using the spectral mantle flow code, or propagator matrix mantle flow code HC by Thorsten Becker. And if the new model has a higher probability of being correct than the old model, we adopt that as our new model. And there's a penalty for over-parameterization in this procedure. So in order to add a parameter to the model, that is to add an additional layer to the viscosity structure, we have to significantly reduce the misfit between the observations and the model geoid. This procedure has a few key benefits. First of all, we don't have to make any assumptions a priori about the smoothness or regularization of the viscosity structure. That is, we don't impose any kind of explicit regularization on the viscosity structure's variation with depth. We don't have to make any a priori assumptions about the interface depths between different layers in the model. We get what's commonly called a parsimonious parameterization, so we seek a model that's as simple as possible and that it has few parameters. And we also obtain, rather than a single best-fitting solution, an ensemble of solutions whose properties reveal uncertainties and trade-offs within the viscosity structure. Let's see. We have to make a few key assumptions in carrying out this exercise, the most important of which is the conversion between seismic velocity anomalies and density anomalies. We have to adopt some kind of conversion factor, commonly called R, between seismic velocity variations and density variations. One way of doing that is using predictions from mineral physics. We used Hephaesto by Stixrud and Lithgow-Bertoloni to calculate for a pyrolytic mantle composition and three different mantle adiabats the predicted relationship between density and seismic velocity. And we use this to scale the seismic velocity anomalies within the tomographic model in order to get density anomalies that drive the forward flow calculations. We also estimated the uncertainty associated with the tomographic model. One way of doing this is by looking at the variability between different existing tomographic models. We did this in some of our inversions, but not all. And we made some estimate of the covariance matrix by randomly sampling kind of blends of these three different relatively recent tomographic models. So I'll show you the results now. This is one solution. We carried out a large number of inversions, and I don't have time to show you all of the results. But in brief, what's being shown here in the left panel is the viscosity contrast, that is the change in viscosity relative to a reference viscosity at some depth. On the vertical axis is depth. So we can see that this inversion recovered an isoviscous upper mantle, a reduction in viscosity between the 660 and 1,000 kilometers depth, and then subsequently an increase in viscosity at around 1,000 kilometers depth. The plot, the third plot here, actually shows the probability of finding a layer interface at a given depth. So we have this layered viscosity structure, and This shows the number of solutions within the posterior population. All of the solutions in this posterior provide a reasonable degree of fit to the observed geoid. And it seems that within this posterior population, a layer interface most commonly occurs at 1,000 kilometers depth, so coincident with the depth at which these funny behaviors are seen in tomographic models. I'll also point out that most of these models have a relatively small number of layers. So the solutions that we're recovering don't have 20 or 30 viscosity layers. They have 2 or 3 for the most part, no more than a handful. And we think that it's impossible to uniquely constrain a viscosity structure with more than 2 or 3 layers, given the quality of the observation, the quality of the observational constraints and the uncertainties, particularly surrounding the density to velocity conversion. So we carried out these inversions for a number of different assumptions about the relationship between densities and seismic velocities. For some of the cases, we used Hephaesto. That's the cases shown in purple. So that's a depth variant conversion factor. In other cases, we used a constant conversion factor. This is something that a large number of previous studies have explored as well. Many of these different solutions have different properties, but you can see that the most robust property of all of these different solutions, despite their considerable variability, is that there seems to be an increase in viscosity below the 660. This is the 660, just to remind you, and this is 1,000 kilometers depth. So it seems that all of these solutions place the location of a viscosity increase between the upper mantle and the lower mantle significantly below the 660, most commonly around 1,000 kilometers depth. This is a type of structure that's hinted at in some previous inversions for the viscosity structure. I'm showing you here on the left our new solutions for the radial viscosity profile. In the middle are a set of viscosity profiles that make different assumptions about the tomographic model used, and also the relationship between density anomalies and velocity anomalies from King and Masters in the 90s. And I think it's important to note that even in this study, they found evidence for an increase in viscosity of maybe a factor of 10 at the 660, and then a subsequent increase, smaller increase in viscosity right around 1,000 kilometers depth. The layer interface depths weren't allowed to go free in these inversions. They were prescribed and just coincident with the layered interfaces present in the then state-of-the-art global tomographic models. I also show for comparison a much more highly parameterized model from Mitrovica and Forte from 2004. In order to recover solutions for these, I think this is a 25-layer model, they have to impose quite a bit of regularization or imposed smoothness on the solution. And I think it's really important to note that the overall variation in viscosity in these models, this goes from 10 to the 15 to 10 to the 25 Pascal seconds. So there's a 1,000-fold variation in viscosity with depth in these models. And in none of our models do we recover overall viscosity variations greater than about a factor of 180. So I'll just quickly summarize the results that we obtained. In most of our models, we find evidence for an increase in viscosity between the 660 and 1,000 kilometers depth. Many of the solutions place the depth of this increase close to 1,000 kilometers. Models in the ensemble solutions have just a handful of layers, 2 to 5. And this is consistent with previous resolving power studies by Archie Paulson from 2007, 2 papers. And the overall variation in viscosity is just a factor of 20. I'll just briefly skip some of this material and say that we did a number of then forward geodynamical, or ran a number of forward geodynamical models. These are quite complicated numerical simulations, similar to models run by McNamara and Zhang 2004. These are thermochemical convection calculations in 3D spherical shell geometry. We solve the Stokes equations with variable viscosity. We use a free slip core mantle boundary, but we impose time-dependent plate motions at the surface. So plate motions based on tectonic reconstructions are imposed at the surface in these models. There's also a depth varying viscosity structure and strongly temperature dependent viscosity, and we include at the base of the mantle a compositionally dense layer. Its density is tuned so that it will remain stable, that is, remain at the CMB without lifting off over the duration of these calculations. And what we've done here is actually varied the interface depth then of the viscosity structure between the upper mantle and the lower mantle. To give you a sense for what these calculations look like, I'll play this movie for you, which shows model spin-up starting 600 million years ago. There's a spin-up phase lasting 150 million years. We start with an adiabatic mantle and a uniformly distributed chemically dense layer at the CMB. What you're seeing is the chemically dense material in gray and the upwelling material in red. The time is now about 400 million years ago, and time-dependent plate motions will start to become more and more apparent. You can see that the chemically dense material has been organized into essentially one large pile at this point, and around the time of Pangaea breakup, now, you'll see that one of these, one large chunk of this material is separated off of the large hemispherical pile, and this becomes something analogous to the Pacific LLSVP, and this becomes something analogous to the African LLSVP. So we did calculations like this with imposed plate motions and a chemically dense layer with different viscosity structures. The two viscosity structures are shown here. One has the interface between the upper mantle and lower mantle at 660 and a viscosity jump of about a factor of 30. And the other has a somewhat larger viscosity increase of about a factor of 100 placed deeper at 1,000 kilometers depth. This is not meant to be necessarily a realistic case, but is meant to be an N-member example so that we can study the depth at which plumes become deflected and also look at the radial correlation structure present in these geodynamic models. Comparing the modeled and observed plume deflection, on the top is a slice through SEM-UCB WM1. This upwelling in yellow here is apparently offset between 1,000 kilometers depth and the 660. In the numerical model, this is one of the LLSVPs in the corresponding location, and we have an upwelling, and you can see that the upwelling is clearly offset and thinned. So introducing a viscosity contrast does indeed result in deflection and thinning of upwelling structures. Looking at the radial correlation structure in these geodynamic models, I show, to remind you, the radial correlation structure in SEM-UCB. So you can see this is for spherical harmonic degree 3. This is for spherical harmonic degrees up to 20. And on the left, you can see that there's a clear change in the correlation structure at 1,000 kilometers depth. The geodynamic models stay much better correlated throughout the whole mantle, but you can see that changes in correlation structure seem to happen at the same depth where there's a viscosity change. So this is the model with a viscosity jump at 660, and you can see that the change in radial correlation structure is pretty clearly coincident with that imposed viscosity contrast. This is a different model with a viscosity increase at 1,000 kilometers depth, so the model is on the right, and again, SEM-UCB is on the left. And what you can see here is that pushing that viscosity contrast deeper and making it larger indeed produces a decorrelation at that depth that appears more in line with what we see in the tomographic models. So yes, pushing the viscosity contrast deeper, on the other hand, based on the fitting exercise that I showed you at the beginning of the talk, requires a smaller viscosity increase. So this model, while it's more consistent with some aspects of the radial correlation structure that we see in these global tomographic models, it may actually be in other ways less consistent with geophysical observations. For instance, with a much more viscous lower mantle, the core mantle boundary heat flux in that model is much lower. So it's going to be necessary to do further exploration in order to find geodynamic models that produce seismic-like correlation structures while also satisfying other geophysical constraints, including the geoid and heat transport considerations. So I'll leave my conclusion slide up now. I'd like to quickly acknowledge CIG for making HC available, and also Thorsten Becker and Craig O'Neill, who wrote the code and contributed it, and also Shiji Zhang and Nan Zhang, who contributed the time-dependent plate motion model and a modified version of SitComS that was used for these calculations. Okay? So that's what I have for you, and I'm happy to take any questions. I think Abby was first.
How does the scale of viscosity variations laterally compare with viscosity variations with depth?
That's a really important question. In all of these inversions, we allow viscosity to vary only with depth. So I think that it was during Ved's talk that he said that we trade physical complexity for parameter space exploration when we take an approach like this. And that means that we need a forward model that runs extremely quickly. So using this propagator matrix technique, we aren't able to introduce lateral variations in viscosity. At the same time, we look only at very, very long wavelength flow. We're only calculating the geoid for spherical harmonic degrees 2 through 7, and at those very long wavelengths, it's unlikely that lateral viscosity variations are significant. Thorsten? Oh, sorry. Yeah.
So at degree up to degree 7, do you have to worry about the effect of the crust at all?
We did worry about the effect of buoyancy contributions in the crust, and especially mapping velocity variations to temperature when they're in fact perhaps compositional. So we strip out all buoyancy contributions from the crust and actually from the whole lithosphere.
So you make those corrections, is that what you're saying? Or?
Yeah, we completely remove all of the buoyancy contributions from the model.
So yeah, for the upper mantle, I mean, we think we know something about the oceanic structure, and that we have an asthenosphere at about 150 kilometers depth that is, you know, in order to lower viscosity than the rest of the upper mantle. That doesn't come in your model. So does that make a difference? I mean, this could be a continental viscosity structure, but for the oceans, we know more about that in the upper part, at least. So that doesn't make any difference then to the depth or to what you find in the deeper part of the mantle?
The very long wavelength geoid, I wish I had a backup slide showing all the geoid kernels or dynamic response functions, but I don't have that here. At very low spherical harmonic degree, the geoid is most sensitive to density variations in the mid and shallow lower mantle. And so I suspect that the reason that we're not recovering any viscosity change associated with the base of the lithosphere is for exactly that region, that we don't have sensitivity in that depth range.
But if you put something like that in a priori in your model, would that make a difference?
I'm not sure. Ved, do you have an answer?
Well, I'm not sure. Maybe we should let Thorsten talk first, but my sense is that it wouldn't do much, certainly at the grip up to degree 7, and partly because, you know, if you think about what the geoid is doing, you're talking about buoyant upwellings and buoyant downwellings, and having a low viscosity asthenosphere is not going to noticeably contribute to your buoyant upwellings or downwellings in that range. But furthermore, their scale has to be enormous for them to matter up to degree 7.
I mean, it's a specific one.
I guess the
if you have upwelling in the whole Pacific, you know,
the
viscosity
structure. Yeah, okay.
Yeah, it's the upwelling and the downwelling that have to be.
Could I just comment on this briefly?
My question is regarding the scaling between velocity and density. Have you tried, by any chance, something that would be for the lowermost mantle that would reflect a dense layer, like something extreme, like an anticorrelation between density and velocity, just to see the effect?
That's an excellent question, and I don't have the cases here, but if you look in the supplementary information for our paper, we actually have some results for calculations that were run with actually no buoyancy contributions at all from the bottom 1,000 kilometers of the Mint. Oh, is it there?
Yes.
The yellow ones here are for calculations that were run then with no buoyancy contributions from the bottom 1,000 kilometers of the mantle. And this is motivated by work that Shiji and his PhD student Shi Lu have done, in which they showed that the competition between thermal and chemical buoyancy in the lowermost mantle may result in actually no net contribution to the long wavelength geoid.
Thanks.
I just wanted to comment and on the effect of lateral viscosity variations. And Max is exactly right that at the longest degrees, the geoid is fairly insensitive to lateral viscosity variations. On the shorter scales, it is not. But what is important to note in this context is that a comprehensive mantle model shouldn't just match the geoid, but also other observables such as the plate velocities. And for the plate velocities, lateral viscosity variations, in particular the existence of plate boundaries, are hugely important. And more than that, the upper 400 kilometers or so are important in terms of, you know, predicting the observations. And what that means for the effect of viscosity is that you will have a trade-off if you do not use lateral viscosity variations in the top 300 kilometers, again restating what Max said. But and further commenting on Uli's concern, what the change in asthenospheric viscosity between continents and ocean does is speed up the oceanic plates. So again, the plate velocities are very sensitive to that lateral difference, but the geoid is not.
Thanks. Shishi is next.
I guess part of the motivation for this kind of viscosity structure at 1,000 kilometer depths is, as you said, is actually about the slab structure. And I guess I would say that a layering, viscosity layering at the 1,000 kilometer depths will not necessarily help to produce flat slab.
I agree.
So that actually will require additional physical mechanisms. Some years ago when people tried to reproduce some kind of flattening of slab about 670, we actually tried that. We tried a viscosity layering at 670. The slabs will just go through and will not be deflect. And back then we had a phase change to help us. I think the question is still there. That is, how you can explain this apparent slab flattening at around the 1,000 kilometer depths. Actually, I'd like to kind of turn the table a little bit to seismologists. And do you all agree on that?
Others can comment, but I think yes, we definitely see it a good agreement now between the p-velocity models, which are very high resolution near subduction zones, but don't have as good resolution elsewhere, and the S models, which don't have as high resolution, but have a better global. So we see the same features. And it's not just my model.
So the Biscuit and the Texas models are similar features?
Steve?
I don't want to get in trouble here. I think the models are pretty similar, but I think to say, oh, that's a flat slab, you have to look at the history of the subduction. If there's a place rolling back and things are dropping in, you're just getting a snapshot in time of what's there. So it's not all subduction zones. And I'm not sure if I would go so far to say as slabs flatten at that point. You know, I think you have to interpret the history of subduction and look at the
for
models.
Sure. Yeah, this is from Fukawa Nobayashi.
So this is from P-Wave.
This is from P-Wave. And similar structures are present for each slides. Yeah.
Some S models and are very compatible.
I think I do.
And no. Even this difference, you know, that some slabs bottom at 660 and others at 1,000, that is also seen in the S models. This is the only one I disagree with. But anyway.
Rather than appealing to a static lower mantle and just a viscosity structure or phase change, I think when you start looking at and interpreting what's happening with slabs, you're starting to represent the terms of the largest still mantle flow and what's actually happening underneath that.
I guess I wanted to make a to follow up on what Shiji said, and I guess also what Magali said. I mean, yeah, I think you're right that these images look compelling, but exactly what they mean in reality is not, at least to me, 100% clear, because even though the slab looks like it laid down, we don't know why, how that might have occurred in the past, and whether or not maybe, in fact, it does continue, but maybe after a long pause during which it loses its seismic signature or something like that. However, to go to Magali's point, you know, this kind of modeling does, in part, take into account the fact that there might be an upwelling, because if you have a low velocity zone, we would make it a low density zone, and so it will want to rise. And on top of it will be a denser slab, which will want to sink. And so those two contributions will kind of affect the geoid that we predict. So it's not that that it's being neglected fully. Of course, the reality... Well, actually, yeah, in the long wavelengths, yes. That's not actually true. So if you take a global tomographic model and you filter it to degree 7, you're right, you won't be able to make out an individual slab, but you will have an area that is faster than average where that slab was, right? It's just like taking off your glasses and taking a look at the picture.
Yeah, it's just to that slide, really, really quick. Can you go back to the previous slide? Wow. That one, I just want to point out on A to E, there is a subduction zone on the left side. You can see some of the seismicity. So there's something going down also on the left side and the right side. And my only point here is it's a lot more complicated than just looking at the color picture and forgetting about what's happening at the surface.
Next, to address the last five comments, right? The point of your forward numerical simulation at the end with the history of plate motion, of viscosity structure, and a model for LLSVPs is to try and simulate what we would see in the actual tomography. And so when you did that exercise, you focused on plumes being deflected, but you didn't tell us anything about what the subducted or sinking component of that convecting system looks like.
Do
you see things that look like they're flattening?
No is the answer. This is actually the downwelling component of the system. So I think I didn't show this movie because I forgot to put the elapsed time on this when I made it several years ago. And this is the behavior of the downwelling. So you're seeing chemically dense material in gold now, and the ponding subducted material is in blue. And in all of these models, downwellings at convergent margins sink vertically, essentially from the point at which they were released into the mantle. So there's nothing in these models to make subduction one-sided or to lead to realistic slab behaviors. That's a challenge for the future. One more question.
Can I ask you a question?
Yeah.
So if viscosity, to me, is a material property, and if you have change in material property there has to be some change in the material, right? So what is that change? You, in your paper, you have list of things that you mentioned.
Uh-huh.
So can I ask you about your favorite out of those list of things?
Well, I think maybe it's better not to display favoritism. I do. I have slides, but it's going to take way too much time, and there's another speaker who's supposed to begin right now.
So we can move on. Should we take?